listening to Unusual Sources here on 93.3 CFMU FM, broadcasting to Hamilton at 93.3 on the FM dial, and the rest of the world at cfmu.mcmaster.ca, our online streaming service. Now, today we're pleased to have prolific blogger, writer, commentator Stephen Gowans on the program today to discuss his latest article on his blog, What's Left. And this article is called The Concept of WMD and Its Use Against Syria and the Propaganda Systems of Western States. It's a detailed article that gets into some big issues. So we're glad that we have Steve on the program here to discuss it with us today. So Steve, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, as I was saying, there's a number of issues to go into here. The discussion around weapons of mass destruction, as it's been termed, lacks a certain maturity and nuance, and the way it's being used is very dangerous. And in your article, you start out by talking about this label, WMD, which stands for Weapons of Mass Destruction. And, I mean, you actually look at it and say, does this category include actual weapons of mass destruction? And you looked at the issue of chemical weapons, for example, and you suggest that chemical weapons really shouldn't be part of this category. Could you tell us why that is?
Yeah, to have any meaning at all, the concept of weapons of mass destruction must include weapons that kill massive numbers of people and exclude those that don't. So a single atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima killed 70,000 people. No one would dispute that atomic bombs, nuclear weapons, are weapons of mass destruction. By contrast, an artillery shell with a typical payload of nerve gas will kill between 75 and 200 people if perfectly delivered under ideal weather conditions. So that's overcast skies with no wind. And if it's delivered over a heavily populated area against unprotected people, there's a moderate wind or the sun is out, the death rate will be 80 to 20 people. So, you know, weapons of mass destruction kill tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people, not tens or hundreds of people as chemical weapons do. So, you know, compared to the single atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima, a single artillery shell with a typical chemical weapons payload will produce a fatality rate of only 0.2% as great as the fatality rate produced by the Hiroshima atom bomb, and that's under ideal conditions, and only 0.02% as great under realistic conditions, so against unprotected people. Against those wearing gas masks or those who have taken shelter indoors, the fatality rate will be infinitesimally small. So, I think a really telling statistic is this. In World War I, it took 70,000 tons of gas to produce as many fatalities as were produced in Hiroshima by a single atom bomb. So, you know, for these reasons, defining chemical weapons as weapons of mass destruction is highly dubious, unless the concept is so diluted that bullets and machetes are also included. I mean, in large quantities, chemical weapons can kill many people. But in large quantities, bullets and machetes can kill many people, too.
Right. There's a certain horror factor, I suppose. But this use of gas and the media attention to gas, it goes back a long way. It's my understanding from your article that this British or American discussion of gas warfare has been used for propaganda purposes in the past, all the way back to World War I. So how did they focus on gas at that time?
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to look at the history of the use of gas. You know, chemical weapons were introduced by the Germans in 1915. And they accounted for less than 1% of battle deaths in World War I. Only 2 to 3% of those who were gassed on the Western Front died. Well, the fatality rate among those who were struck by bullets or shrapnel was 10 to 12 times higher. And it took 1 ton of gas to produce a single fatality. So after the war, some military analysts argued that gas was a comparatively humane weapon, so it incapacitated troops without killing them, or it killed few, comparatively few.
in general, in military terms, it's, I think it was found to be the case that gas was just simply less effective pound for pound than conventional weapons. It, you know, it was a horrible weapon because it did produce suffering, even though it didn't kill people, necessarily. But, you know, on the battlefield, it was the opposite of a weapon of mass destruction in some sense. Because, pound for pound in terms of either, shells or whatever, it was not as effective as artillery shells. That debate, and the discussion of that matter continued on, but now more recently, you had the creation of this concept of weapons of mass destruction where gas was slotted in alongside nuclear weapons and biological weapons. And as you point out, we can easily understand why nuclear weapons are a weapon of mass destruction or potentially biological weapons as well. Gas was slipped into that category, but the United States created this concept of weapons of mass destruction. It's a more recent historical term. I think it was 92 they did that. So why did they come up with that 20 years ago?
Right. And, well, okay, I'll answer that and also answer the earlier question you asked that I didn't answer, which was about the British reaction to chemical weapons in 1915. And, you know, you have this idea that gas is more reprehensible than killing with bullets and shrapnel. And that comes ultimately from the British in the First World War. So the Germans were the first to introduce gas in 1915, and the British emphasized the inhuman aspects of gas to try to draw the United States into the war on their side. So they used this deception, which was used by many other states subsequently, that their weapons were humane, but the weapons uniquely used by the other side were inhumane. So, you know, 80,000 soldiers died from gas in World War I. Even if all those fatalities were British, the number would pale in comparison to the hundreds of thousands and possibly as many as 750,000 German civilians who perished from hunger and disease as a result of the British blockade of Germany. So importantly, I mean, the British were pointing out a weapon that they weren't using at the time and saying, well, that's, you know, uniquely inhuman. And it's also estimated that they, or not estimated, believe that they overstated the number of gas fatalities by four. And this had a propaganda purpose, and the propaganda purpose was to draw the United States into the war. Now, initially, weapons of mass destruction was a term to denote nuclear weapons or weapons of similar destructive capacity that might be developed in the future. In 1989, George H.W. Bush, so the father of George W., departed, you know, from this convention of weapons of mass destruction as a category that included nuclear weapons or future weapons that would be even more destructive than nuclear weapons. And he used the term weapons of mass destruction in an address to the UN in connection with chemical weapons. And at that point, he pledged to eliminate the United States' chemical weapons within 10 years. The Pentagon has yet to relinquish its chemical weapons and has no plans to do so before 2023. And also we have U.S. allies like Israel and Egypt have chemical weapons. I should just mention parenthetically that in 2003, Syria proposed to the United Nations Security Council that the Middle East become a chemical weapons-free zone. And the proposal was blocked by the United States, likely to shelter Israel from giving up its own store of chemical weapons. So then, you know, if you trace the evolution of weapons of mass destruction further, in 1990, so right on the eve of the Gulf War, the White House begins to talk about Iraq as, quote, an emergent regional superpower bristling with weapons of mass destruction. And this is a reference to Baghdad's chemical weapons and its ballistic missiles. Now, you know, chemical weapons and ballistic missiles are not weapons of mass destruction. But it was useful for Washington to transform Iraq from, you know, being seen realistically as a comparatively weak country militarily that could carry out chemical weapons attacks because they had chemical weapons, but each of which would kill a few thousand at most under favorable conditions, to being seen unrealistically as a weapons of mass destruction threat. And the purpose of elevating Iraq from a non-threat to a large threat was to soften public opinion for a series of wars and massively destructive sanctions that would soon be rolled out against the country. And I think Washington's problem with Iraq wasn't that it bristled with weapons of mass destruction, which it didn't, but that it bristled against subservience to kind of the interlocked political and economic goals of Washington and Wall Street. Because, you know, as an Arab nationalist state with a publicly owned economy, sitting on an ocean of oil, Iraq was a prime target for U.S. aggression. And deceiving the Western public into believing Iraq was a WMD threat would secure public support for a campaign of war and sanctions and ultimately regime change and absorption of Iraq into the United States' informal empire. So if you look at how the weapons of mass destruction concept evolved, in 1992, as, you know, these massively destructive sanctions were being rolled out against Iraq, which ultimately led to hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of deaths in Iraq due to hunger and disease. In 1992, the U.S. law defines chemical and biological weapons as weapons of mass destruction. Now, you know, we've gone from nuclear weapons, which truly do kill tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people, to chemical weapons that kill hundreds, or at best, thousands of people. Then in 1994, radiological weapons are included. And these are, you know, radioactive material that is paired with a conventional explosion. And the idea is that you disperse this radioactive material. Oh, radiological weapons are kind of ridiculous because anyone who's irradiated by them will be killed by the explosion before they ever die from radiation poisoning. And then also explosives were added to the definition of weapons of mass destruction. So under U.S. law, almost all weapons apart from modern rifles and pistols are included under the weapons of mass destruction umbrella. So, I mean, this is a vast extension of the concept that renders it completely meaningless. And I think now its purpose is to connote something bad, you know, weapons of mass destruction are bad, without denoting anything meaningful, because the concept is just so broad, it covers almost everything.
Right. Well, I remember watching footage of the preparations for the Gulf War. There was a lot of fear at that time of Iraq's military capabilities, which we know was wildly exaggerated in the first Gulf War. And what you point out here is, of course, yes, Iraq had no nuclear weapons. It did not have nuclear weapons. It did not have any real deterrence capability against the United States. It didn't have submarines with nuclear weapons. It did not have ICBMs. It did not have bombers with nuclear weapons. It could not deter a nuclear state. So what, of course, you have is the addition of chemical weapons to that category, even though they don't have the same impact on a superpower like the United States. So moving on from there, you point out the U.S. has used its own strategies against countries like Iraq, which includes sanctions, much as the British did in World War One. There was a blockade of Germany. Now you have sanctions without a war at first. The sanctions killed a great number of people. People might be familiar with Madeleine Albright's quote on that matter, where she acknowledged the number of children who had been killed by sanctions, saying that the price is worth it. But, you know, there's no use of the term sanctions of mass destruction, even though they killed quite a large number of people, most of whom were civilians.
Yeah, and far more people than could ever be killed by all of the chemical weapons in Iraq's arsenal. And, you know, the proffered or the ostensible reason for imposing those sanctions was to force the Iraqi government to relinquish its weapons of mass destruction, which was really a reference to its chemical weapons. So the result was the killing of hundreds of thousands, if not over a million Iraqis, to eliminate a class of weapons that could not possibly produce anywhere near the same number of fatalities.
Well, look what they've done to Iraq. I mean, people have used the term sociocide, the destruction of an entire society, to describe what happened to Iraq. You know, but now we're seeing somewhat of a replay of this over the issue of Syria. you know, when they're coming up with their script as to how they're going to intervene in Syria, how do they justify intervention? They went through, the usual routine. There was democracy, freedom. One of them was chemical weapons. So they brought in the WMD story to Syria. And they said, well, you know, Syria, it has these chemical weapons. It could use these chemical weapons, and we got to go in there and disarm them to save everybody. So there was an agreement negotiated to remove the chemical weapons from Syria. But they still want to try to accuse or paint the government as using chemical weapons in Syria, which somehow becomes a justification or a red line for U.S. intervention. You don't think that the Syrian government is likely to be using many or any chemical weapons. So why do you think that is?
Well, you know, it's impossible to say definitively that the Syrian forces haven't used chemical weapons in Syria, but it's also impossible to say definitively that U.S. forces haven't either. And so negatives can't be proved, but there are compelling political and military reasons that would prevent the Syrian government from using chemical weapons, including chlorine gas, which they're being accused of using right now. And so these constraints make the allegations against the Syrian government unconvincing. So, I mean, what are the constraints? I mean, political and military ones. The military ones, as I've just pointed out, is that chemical weapons aren't very effective. And they're not as effective as, or they're only equally as effective, and in many cases not as effective as bombs and shrapnel and bullets and you know, strikes by jet fighters. Almost the idea that the Syrian government would be using chemical weapons is subtly racist. I mean, we would never say that the U.S. Marines used chemical weapons or, say, chlorine gas dropped from barrel bombs or dropped in barrel bombs dropped from helicopters. This is the allegation being made against Syria now. We'd never say that the U.S. Marines would have done that in Fallujah. We'd never say that the Israeli Defense Forces would have done that in their latest siege of Gaza. And no one would believe they would do that, because they would say, why would they do that? Why would they use a terribly ineffective weapon? If we're talking about chlorine gas. Chlorine gas is a nuisance. It makes people sick. It doesn't kill them. It kills them rarely, but it mostly makes them sick. So we'd never believe that the U.S. Marines would use this when they have, you know, phosphorus weapons and bullets and all kinds of other formidable military equipment. We wouldn't believe the Israelis would use that. So why would we believe that the Syrians would do this? I mean, the military logic or the military reasons for not using chemical weapons and not using chlorine gas are as compelling for the Syrian army as they are for the U.S. Marines or for the IDF. So there's this military reason not to use chemical weapons. There's also a political consideration. And the political consideration is, as soon as U.S. President Barack Obama laid down this red line, which said that if the Syrians use chemical weapons, that would justify a missile strike against the Syrian government. Well, as soon as he said that, I mean, there's a compelling reason, political reason, you know, apart from the compelling military reasons, not to use chemical weapons. So, you know, there are already reasons why we would believe the Syrian government wouldn't use chemical weapons. Then, there's absolutely no hard evidence that they did. I was rereading some of the allegations that have been made against the Syrian government over the last 3 years about chemical weapons use. And when you look at those allegations, that's all they are. They're allegations. They take the form of there's evidence that chemical weapons were used in Syria, or there's evidence that chlorine gas attacks were mounted in Syria. Therefore, the Syrian government must be responsible. And when challenged to produce any evidence, no evidence is produced. Instead, we have Western state officials make statements like, we have serious suspicions that it is the Syrian government that's using these weapons. So, absence of evidence and compelling military and political reasons why the Syrian government wouldn't use chemical weapons.
Yeah, well, it's mostly just used as a talking point against the Syrian government. And as you point out, this WMD concept, it's something that the other guys do. The bad guys do. Not us nice U.S. military, Israel, Canada. We don't do that. But Syria, Iraq, maybe Gaddafi in Libya, maybe they got WMDs. And it becomes just a catch-all term to designate things that we might be able to pin on a certain country.
Right, and we do it. Even Canada. I mean, there's this underreported story that happened just a few weeks ago that the North Koreans were very upset about. But you could see it reported in the Wall Street Journal. And that is, there was this mini scandal. The mini scandal was that the Pentagon had shipped anthrax spores to weapons laboratories around the world. And they went to one in Canada. And they went to a weapons laboratory in South Korea. Now, the scandal wasn't that the Pentagon is sending biological weapons to its allies. The scandal was that they sent live anthrax spores rather than dead ones. Canada's involved in biological weapons. You could argue that biological weapons aren't weapons of mass destruction either. But there's still these kind of unconventional weapons that we attribute to so-called enemies, and we would pretend that we wouldn't use them ourselves.
Well, you know, Canada, United States, many NATO countries have chemical and biological weapons research facilities. It's often claimed it's for defensive research, but of course, weapons are developed in these laboratories. You know, and we're supposed to forget that, you know, United States used Agent Orange in Vietnam, or that, you know, that may have been produced in Canada. There's phosphorus weapons that have been used by Israel. Saudi Arabia is said to be using cluster munitions in Yemen. We just don't talk about that application of weapons. But I wanted to sort of move this to the bigger picture. You earlier had mentioned that the U.S. created this conception of weapons of mass destruction in 1989, 1992, in that period when they're revving up for the Gulf War, number one, and pursuing that. And it seems to me that, I mean, this is an attempt to impose U.S. law or NATO-related visions onto the entire world. And it's also an attempt to move away from the way that international law used to be structured. So listeners to this program are probably somewhat familiar with the post-war order after World War II that emphasized sovereignty, non-intervention, and the use of the United Nations to resolve disputes along the lines of international law. The United States never liked that, especially in the post-Cold War period where it wanted to become more robustly interventionist and it needed to create new frameworks by which to intervene in other people's countries. One of those was the humanitarian intervention and the responsibility to protect. But, you know, a companion idea has been the idea that there are weapons of mass destruction and the U.S. needs to go and bomb the hell out of some country into non-existence in order to protect us from a 50-year-old chemical shell. So the WMD seems to be to move away from the non-intervention and international law and use a more selective idea where the U.S. can designate what a weapons of mass destruction is and thereby use it to illegally intervene because they said so, essentially.
Yeah, and central to these violations of sovereignty is to justify the violation of sovereignty by pointing to a moral imperative. The moral imperative is that sovereignty is, you know, has to be subordinate to the moral imperative of intervening to stop some kind of barbarity. And hence, that's where weapons of mass destruction have a role to play in kind of softening up public support for interventions abroad which violate sovereignty. And so we can see that happening in Syria. I mean, the Syrian government has been vilified repeatedly over the last 4 years. And and the result is that you can present really poor evidence. You can just make claims like the Syrian government, ridiculous claims. The Syrian government is using chlorine gas to attack whoever, and then you can find evidence of chlorine gas use. And given that you've vilified the Syrian government repeatedly, it's not difficult to make the claim stick that if chlorine gas is being used, it must be the Syrian government. It couldn't be anyone else.
Well, where there's smoke, there's fire, is the saying. So the idea is if you create enough smoke, people are going to assume there's a fire. So if your newspapers every 3 months report Assad may be using chemical weapons, and then they don't prove it, but they keep saying that. It sticks in people's minds. So the next time you say, well, they're using chemical weapons, you just assume, well, they must be using chemical weapons because I read in the newspaper before that they'd been using chemical weapons. I read that the Syrian government did this, that it did that. And these things don't need to be confirmed or verified, but you just repeat these claims enough, and you'll sooner or later you can have people believing that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, for example.
Right, and you keep calling them brutal dictators, and they're barbaric, and killing their own people, et cetera, et cetera. So now you've established this moral imperative to intervene. I mean, who cares about sovereignty when there are monsters in the world?
Yes, it's a fairy tale narrative. It's always a barbaric dictator using horrible weapons against his own people. They don't talk about the context of what's happening. In the case of Syria, it's to distract us from a larger issue. So they want to have you thinking, did Assad use chemical weapons? Did they not use chemical weapons? Meanwhile, you know, the bigger issue is that the United States has been talking about how much funding is going to Contras in Syria, how much funding is going to illegal foreign fighters, mercenaries, terrorists, and so on that have gone into Syria. How much is the U.S. going to fund them? How much is the U.S. going to train them? How much is the U.S. going to provide equipment for them? And then how much, you know, how Turkey has been allowing safe passage and armed escort for these people and giving direct military support to basically an invasion of Syria. You have Saudi Arabia funding all sorts of extremists who have committed all sorts of vile acts which have been publicized by these extremists, and you can find them yourself. So, you know, there's just an invasion of Syria. It has caused great devastation in Syria. It's done semi-openly by NATO, by the United States, by Turkey, and by friends like Saudi Arabia. And Israel's been giving a hand as well. It's been bombing Syrian targets. It's been putting ISIS or al-Nusra, which particular group, the FSA, but they've been going back and forth across the border and getting medical aid. And
al-Nusra, yes.
So, you know, that's all happening. And we're supposed to just ignore that and say, oh, my goodness, let's point fingers. Look at that Mr. Assad. He might be using chemical weapons, according to the New York Times and according to groups that are allied with the armed opposition in Syria. So it's a complete distraction. I mean, I don't know how much the world has changed since the end of World War II, but the idea back then was, you know, you can prevent a lot of suffering if you don't have countries sending fighters and weapons into other countries. But of course, that's what we're doing. So we are engaging in aggression, armed aggression against Syria. And then we're saying, well, look what the government, it might be doing something bad. We've got to go in there and save everyone.
Yeah, an armed aggression of forces that are otherwise called terrorists.
Well, then it gets to the other issue, too. You know, in terms of weapons, we're talking about weapons when we should be talking about war. So there's the issue. Syrian government has an army, and it has weapons. So, you know, the question is, or the newspapers, are they using bad weapons? Are they using WMDs, chlorine gas? The question is not what weapons are you using, but is a war justified? Is it justified to send in terrorists into Syria? Is it justified to break a number of international laws in that respect? If the Syrian government is being attacked, then it has a right to defend itself. You know, and you can quibble about what weapon is being used, or you can say, is it okay what NATO is doing? Is it okay what Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel, United States are doing? And if it's not okay, they should stop doing it, and then you're not going to see a whole bunch of weapons being used. So they distracted us from the question of war and are looking just at weapons. And, you know, and it goes on the other side of the coin, too, with regard to the United States. I know that the United States has used some novel weapons in its what it calls the war on terror. You have the example of the Predator drones. And, you know, it's very upsetting to see the handiwork of these Predator drones in various countries. Mm-hmm. You know, and I certainly don't like the way they're being used. I don't like them. But, you know, the Predator drones are a great symbol of this war on terror, this partly remote, highly mechanized war against predominantly poor people, mostly kills civilians. So, you know, the Predator drones are kind of emblematic of this war on terror. But, you know, in my view, the problem isn't that Predator drones are being used as opposed to, you know, an aircraft with a person inside it shooting people. I don't see that as being the big issue. The big issue for me is that the United States is in a bunch of semi-declared or undeclared wars in a number of countries, you know, from Yemen to Pakistan to Afghanistan to all over the place. There are these drones being used because the United States is involved militarily in other people's countries. Uh-huh. And, you know, it doesn't matter if they're using Predator drones or if they're using manned aircraft or cruise missiles or whatever they're using. Most of these attacks kill civilians. They kill people who don't want to be involved in this conflict. They're not in a declared war, these actions are often quite illegal. So I think, you know, that's the real problem, is you have an ongoing, never-ending war on terror that continues to suck up country after country into it, like some kind of whirlpool. All these people are getting killed on the outskirts. All these voiceless people are being killed by a variety of devices. So, you know, you can bring attention to the Predator drone and say, well, that's a, you know, look at that thing and what it does to all those villages and weddings and blowing up villagers. But I think the real problem is not the existence of the Predator drone itself, but what it represents. And it represents this idea that the United States can intervene all over the place and it shoot who it wants, bomb who it wants, and it doesn't have to answer to anyone.
Yeah. And so what you're saying is the emphasis is on the means of waging war, which then obscures the question of what is the war just? What are the reasons for waging these wars?
Mm-hmm.
And as you point out, I mean, when we're talking about Syria, we're actually, and we're talking about the war waged by the Syrian government. We're talking about a defensive war against aggression carried out by foreign-backed anti-government jihadists. These are, you know, jihadists backed, as you mentioned, by Saudi Arabia, by Turkey, by these Gulf tyrannies, by NATO. And it's also strange that we have this so-called coalition against the terrorism of ISIS, which consists of a whole bunch of countries that are supporting terrorism in Syria. And you're right. I mean, the issue of what weapons are being used is kind of irrelevant. You know, you could argue that the Syrian government should be able to use chemical weapons if they were militarily effective. Maybe they would. You know, is it any less reprehensible for someone to be killed by bleeding to death from a bullet in the gut or being crushed to death in a collapsed building that was struck by a missile than it is to choke to death from gas? So I don't know, I agree with you entirely. I mean, the issue here is, are these wars just? What are the reasons for the wars? Not what are the means by which they're being undertaken,
or
being used.
After the Second World War, the idea that all the countries agreed on was that war is bad, that war leads to all these atrocities, people being crushed in their houses by bombs, people being burned, all sorts of other calamities and catastrophes occur because of war. So the idea is to prevent war, especially needless wars, wars of aggression, people going into someone else's country for their own geopolitical reasons. That was seen as the number one demon. Don't start a war, because if you start a war, there will be all sorts of atrocities. And now we've been moving away from that and not saying don't start a war. Now we're saying, well, what kind of, you know, is that guy using this weapon that we've arbitrarily decided is a banned category? You know, we can use these weapons. We'll use cluster bombs. We'll use guided munitions against civilians, and we're not going to complain about it. We'll let Saudis use cluster bombs. But we're going to say these guys can't use that weapon. And, you know, no. That's letting the U.S. make the rules while it breaks the rules. You know, it's making the rules about what weapons are good and what weapons are bad while it blows up country after country, creating enormous devastation, right? We've had millions of casualties in Iraq, millions of refugees in Iraq, now millions of refugees in Syria. You know, you have the destruction of Libya. You had the sanctions in the 90s, which killed Iraqis as well. And you can make a list of all the casualties from all the U.S. interventions in just 20 years. Most of them were done with conventional weapons or sanctions. And we're not supposed to cry about that. And yeah. I think we really need to take a turn and say, you know, Americans, we know Americans are largely getting tired of this war on terror, and it's having domestic effects too, with increased repression and so on. So, you know, we have to go back to the understanding of why are we upset about the war. We know there's a lot of lies being told. We know that there's a lot of innocent people dying. We know that there's a lot of money being wasted. We know that there's these domestic effects as well. It's a war of choice. It's a war of aggression, and people can intrinsically sense that. So people can oppose the war because it's unjust, because it's illegal, because it goes against the understanding of why the United Nations was created, and not get fixated on these very distracting questions of weapons. You know, ultimately, I think we need to oppose war more than we oppose specific weapons.
Yes, we need to oppose unjust wars, I mean, without a question. I should mention, too, and there are lots of crocodile tears cried over the refugees in Syria and the numberless people who have been killed in the war, especially by the United States and its allies. And yet these are crocodile tears, because if they really cared about the refugees, if they really cared about all the people who are dying, they wouldn't be funding the the jihadists who are waging the war in the first place.
It's a very two-faced concept. It's like WMDs are a sign that they place over a country that they're about to attack. They say, these guys have this arbitrarily labeled weapon. We got to go in there and save them. And it turns out to be like the movie Team America World Police, where they just blow up everything. And, you know, you're not fooling as many people as you did before, and it's not appreciated either. So, you know, in any case, you know, what we need to be pushing for, I think, is winding down these various forms of aggression and these quasi, you know, part wars. You know, they're not necessarily the U.S. invading a country directly, but, you know, organizing, funding, and making possible conditions and situation through which you have Contras and insurgents going into other people's countries, like Syria. That's almost as, you know, as big a danger and big a violation as just putting tanks across the border itself. So, you know, there's some real big in-the-clear violations going on here, and they're not being talked about so much. And instead, yeah, there is a focus on often illusory or imaginary weapons. So I'm glad that you pointed that out in your blog. And I know you've dealt with that category before. And I just like the way that you try to point our attention to the big issues that are being missed because of these deliberate distractions. So I appreciate the work you're doing on that, and I look forward to seeing more on all of those categories. So I just wanted to thank you for coming on the program and talking about that and sharing with us your elaboration of those details. So you know, thanks for taking the time with us today, Steve.
And thank you for having me.
Okay, well, we can find you at gowans.wordpress.com. Is that right?
That's correct.
Okay, people know where to go. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
That was Stephen Gowans of the blog What's Left. And in fact, that article that we're discussing is the one presently at the top of the page there if you want to check that out. So yeah, time to put on your critical thinking caps. Anyway, we just got a couple announcements. We'll be back.